This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is out this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. And here's EU Ambassador Gordon Sondland famously repeating,
"Everyone was in the loop. Was there a quid pro quo? The answer is yes. Everyone was in the loop."
He spoke at the impeachment inquiry this week, over which Democrat Adam Schiff presided, serving up an evidence-based narrative, countered by Republican Devin Nunes' unfounded one. I make this assessment on facts available to all. And here's Ukraine diplomat David Holmes.
"The three priorities of security, economy, and justice, and our support for Ukrainian democratic resistance to Russian aggression, became overshadowed by a political agenda promoted by former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani and a cadre of officials operating with a direct channel to the White House."
And former White House Russia expert Fiona Hill.
"Some of you on this committee appear to believe that Russia and its security services did not conduct a campaign against our country, and that perhaps, somehow, for some reason, Ukraine did. This is a fictional narrative that has been perpetrated and propagated by the Russian security services themselves."
The so-called legacy media saw testimony confirmed by many of a quid pro quo for personal gain. Or was there? Trump's defenders had nothing. Or did they? Fox News commentator Jesse Waters.
"The hoax is over. I mean, you guys tried, you failed. You didn't have one witness to testify that Trump directed a quid pro quo involving military aid. Not one."
Fox News host Sean Hannity.
"This was the day the Democrats, Trump, Ukraine, quid pro quo, coup, impeachment attempt, and hoax officially died."
"The odd thing about this entire affair is that we've known the truth about the president in the Ukraine almost from the very beginning. I mean, he said on the White House lawn to reporters that he did it."
That's David Roberts, who covers energy and politics for Vox, who set out to answer the eternal question, how can the president's defenders on Capitol Hill and on Fox News and such like media keep denying the obvious, keep repeating narratives and timelines and outright BS that is continually, definitively debunked? An NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll published earlier this week found that two-thirds of Americans say nothing they hear in the impeachment inquiry would cause them to change their minds about whether Trump ought to be impeached. David Roberts calls this a pivotal moment in our epistemic crisis, meaning the crisis in how we acquire knowledge?
Right. The crisis in how we come to know things, how we learn things, what we count as true, who we trust. And by the crisis, I just mean we're sort of splitting into two worlds, not just two different sets of values or priorities or sort of visions for the country, but two different fact sets. And you get people dug in to where they're saying things to pollsters like, look, I picked my side. I don't care what anyone says anymore.
The Democrats have the field, they have the talent, they have the facts, they have the format, but you argue that it is very much in doubt that they could win.
By any sort of objective standard, if there were a referee, the referee would have stepped in and said, this is over, you guys have established your case. But it is the lack of referees that is precisely the problem. You would have to have a referee whose word is respected by both sides of the contest. And that's what we don't have anymore. So one side's referees can say, hey, we think it's over and obvious. And the other side's referees can just say, no, we refuse to acknowledge it. And in that circumstance, there's just no way to finish the game.
So you argued in a piece last weekend on Vox that this moment is defined by tribal epistemology, and that it's kind of like tribal morality.
Right. So it's tribal morality, I think, is something people are more familiar with. It's when you decide the welfare of my tribe, my group, takes precedence over principles. So, for instance, in the mid-2000s, we had a big national debate about torture. And the sort of two sides, one was saying, no, don't torture is a principle. It applies to everyone, right? Us and them. But the other side was saying, look, no, we're good people. We're on the side of right. So if we torture, it's okay, because our tribe is good, so what we do is good. And tribal epistemology is just the same thing. You put your tribal interests ahead of sort of epistemological principles of evidence and self-correction and self-criticism and peer review, all these sort of mechanisms we have for determining truth. You just put your tribe's interests ahead of those. So you end up saying, we're going to believe whatever is useful for us in the moment to believe.
I was thinking about the ejection by the president of members of the tribe for betrayal and, as you might put it, epistemic transgressions.
Yes.
For example, we have a tape of Representative Jim Himes questioning Jennifer Williams on Tuesday. She worked for Pence. She also worked for Obama and the Bush administration before that and for the Bush-Cheney reelection campaign.
Ms. Williams, on Sunday, the president personally targeted you in a tweet. It reads, tell Jennifer Williams, whoever that is, to read both transcripts of the presidential calls and see the just-released statement from Ukraine. Then she should meet with the other never-Trumpers, who I don't know and mostly never even heard of, and work out a better presidential attack.
Two things are notable about that. As you say, the entire weight of her experience and previous commitments when she crossed the tribe, it was tissue paper. It meant nothing. And secondly, Trump has sort of like exacerbated all this in the sense that his behavior is so erratic and his sort of assertions are sort of changing day by day. So there's no way to even kind of pretend anymore that you're basing your defense of him on principles. He makes that impossible. So if you want to be a member of the tribe in good standing, you have to go along with all of Trump's veering back and forth. The fact that Mike Pence did nothing to step up and defend her shows that he knows the game. Like, well, if this is the way Trump veered today, oh well, I'm following him come what may.
People generally are too busy to pay close attention to politics. They pay attention to fragments and they use shorthand. And I wanted you to talk about those heuristics.
I think it's perfectly normal, and it's not in any way derogatory to say that most people just sort of see headlines here and there, watch the nightly news occasionally, scroll past it on Facebook, and so they have to use heuristics, shortcuts. And one heuristic that's very strong in all people, I think, is this sense that if something is valid, if it makes sense, it will command at least some agreement from both sides of a controversy, right? If you can get consensus, it's a signal of legitimacy. To take an example, if we see a Republican come forward and say something's wrong with this behavior that Trump did, we sort of grant it a little bit more weight. But the problem is, what Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader, figured out when Obama was elected, it's fully in my power to just give him consensus and agreement across party lines on nothing. The voting public won't understand the mechanisms of Washington well enough to know that it's me doing it. They just look up and see the president and they say, gosh, everything Obama does just causes a big fight. So if the public is just grumpy and disgusted and tuned out because the whole thing seems like a ridiculous squabble that never ends, that is absolutely to the Republicans' benefit. Our base will fight alongside us every step of the way, and the sort of unengaged middle is going to see this mess and just tune out.
So when we talk about Trump's base, we're talking about under a quarter of registered voters. But what's going on in the Hill now isn't about them. They're already on board. This is about that 30%, according to the NPR PBS Maris poll, that says their minds are still open to information coming to light in the hearings. So what do the president's defenders need this 30% of us to do or not do?
As I said, the way to make people dismiss something is just to make it look partisan, which is why they keep attacking the process itself. And what they want is for that 30% to look at this spectacle and say, oh, it's just more of this. I don't care. I'm going to tune out. That's what they want and need, is for nothing to break through to that fuzzy middle.
I also think that there's this effort to make these proceedings incomprehensible.
Yes, well, it's just the starkest dichotomy as you're watching now of these sort of somber Democrats asking factual questions, and then Nunes coming in with these sort of random conspiracy theories that if you aren't closely following Fox in the kind of right-wing bubble, you wouldn't even recognize what he's referring to. Like,
Democrats on this very committee negotiated with people who they thought were Ukrainians in order to obtain nude pictures of Trump.
Believe me, you don't need to know. But my point is, like, there's this whole menagerie of conspiracy theories that you won't even know what they are unless you're in that bubble. And those are the people that Republicans are speaking to. So if you're just a member of the general public, they're literally not going to make sense to you.
We saw a perfect example of this on Tuesday when Nunes said this.
Well, Ambassador and Mr. Morrison, I have some bad news for you. TV ratings are way down. Way down. I don't hold it personally. I don't think it's you guys. But whatever drug deal the Democrats are cooking up here on the dais, American people aren't buying it.
What's amazing about that to me is it shows that Trump's mentality is infusing the party. Now, to someone like me or you who cares what are the facts of the case, whether or not it's getting good ratings seems very obviously irrelevant. But if there is no such thing as truth, if there's only one side's truth and the other side's truth, then the performance of the argument is the only thing. And so to Nunes, the fact that the Democrats' performance isn't drawing ratings is entirely relevant. In his mind, there is nothing but competing performances going on here.
You wrote that Democrats are attempting to do something that arguably nothing since the 9/11 attacks has done: unite Americans in a clear understanding of a threat and a clear will to action. And you wrote that at this point, it seems entirely possible that it won't happen. So what then?
Well, I want to predict that it's going to fall apart, because you can't operate a movement in a country based on fantasies. But on the flip side, I kind of thought that a long time ago, and it sort of defied gravity. Sort of the other way, you know, the other way things can go is if this sort of cultish, increasingly authoritarian movement takes over the country. In Russia and Turkey and Poland, right? It's a disturbingly longer and longer list. We see countries that we thought were democracies devolve into this. In the U.S., so much has happened in the last few years that we thought would never happen. I think we should really loosen up our imaginations as to what can happen when a movement that is convinced that everything it knows and loves is in danger of falling apart, a movement that's thinking like that, unconnected anymore to facts or reality, and got its hands on the power of the federal government, is the basic recipe for democracies falling apart.
Hannah Arendt once said, no matter how large the tissue of falsehood that an experienced liar has to offer, it will never be large enough to cover the immensity of factuality. But I guess she never reckoned with cable news and the internet.
Right. I mean, she didn't know about Facebook. I mean, this is how these things work, right? Like, historians are going to look back and they're going to say, whoa, that was an unpleasant and ridiculous episode. And there's going to be, you know, sort of hearings. We right ourselves eventually, it seems like. But it would be nice if for once, when we're in the middle of one of these episodes, we could just stop it while it's happening. You have to think, what could intervene and stop what looks like a spiral toward a really grim conclusion? And that's kind of my impulse in writing the column, is to just sort of smack people upside the head and get them to start thinking, like, these are not normal times. What would be sufficient to break through this frozen partisan drift toward collapse? And I really feel like the general public needs to get engaged here, because there's real dangers lurking around every corner here.
David, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
David Roberts writes about energy and politics for Vox. Coming up, how algorithms deepen our dangerous misconceptions about how the world works.
If I get to define success for myself, that's one thing. But if Facebook is defining success for me, I don't trust it.
Good times. This is On the Media.